We'll pick up where we left off on Wednesday. So we were trying to use instantons to compute the energy splitting between the two lowest lying states in a symmetric double well potential. So we'll compute that, finish that computation today, as well as briefly discuss a few other applications of instantons in quantum mechanics that will be directly relevant to the quantum field theory case. And time permitting, we will start our generalization of this instanton technique to the quantum field theory case. And what we'll see is that unlike some other techniques for computing non-perturbative effects, this technique generalizes in a rather straightforward manner, and we can almost we can reuse many of our results that we derived in the quantum mechanical case with a few changes that we'll discuss. Okay, so what we were trying to do last time was compute the energy splitting between the two lowest lying states in the symmetric double well potential. And what we found is that there was an instanton solution that solved the Euclidean equations of motion. And it looks something like this. That's through the origin here. Where this was minus t over 2. T over 2. So this solved the Euclidean equations of motion with the boundary conditions that the particle started at the minimum at minus a and ended up at the minimum at plus a. And there's an anti-instanton solution, which is at the time reverse of this. So in order to find the ground state energy, what we need to do is compute the Euclidean action of our solution. And that's rather straightforward to do. So the Euclidean action of this bound solution we found. I'll give a name, I'll just call it S0. And that's equal to the integral from minus t over 2 to t over 2, the Euclidean time of a half the x bar the tau squared plus v x bar. And to compute this, we can just change our integration variable from Euclidean time to x. We do that, our integral becomes an integral from minus a, so the particle's at minus a at minus t over 2, and it ends up at a, the x bar, we'll get it to tau, the x bar, and half, I'll just abbreviate this by x dot, that's dx d tau, plus v. And so remember, this was a zero energy solution to the equations of motion, which means that the x bar d tau is just the square root of 2v. That's because the energy of this solution is zero. So we can rewrite this as just the integral from minus a to a dx bar of square root of 2v. And so this looks very much like the exponent that I claimed it we should get at the beginning of Wednesday's lecture. So we're on the right track. But if we want to compute the ground state energy, we need to include all of the possible instanton configurations, or all of the possible solutions to the Euclidean equations of motion that have a finite non-zero action. So we found one, or rather a one family set, because as I mentioned last time, this instanton can be centered anywhere, at least in the t goes to infinity limit. So centered it at any location. And so if we just look at the contributions from this one parameter family of solutions, the amplitude we're trying to compute, which was amplitude n dot a after a Euclidean time big T, starting from a, so the contributions from to this amplitude we've found so far should just be some normalization times a factor k, which is proportional to the determinant of S double prime. The minus a half. So that would, if we went to like next order, we would get a term that was the determinant, just like we saw in QFT2, times e to the minus Euclidean action of our bounce of our instanton solution divided by h bar. So each of the solutions with a particular center will contribute something like this. But I've argued that the center can be anywhere. So we should include all of those solutions with any possible center. If we want to do that, we need to integrate over the possible locations of the center. And the fact that the center can be anywhere means that, well, there is some direction in configuration space where if we take a given instanton solution with a particular center and we perturb it a little bit, so we basically shift the center by an infinitesimal amount, that solution will have exactly the same action. So that tells us that there is some flat direction in configuration space. So that means that the operator S double prime is going to have a zero eigenvalue if we do an infinitesimal translation of the of our solution. We're not changing the action, so there's some flat direction, so there's some zero eigenvalue, which we've already accounted for by integrating over the possible centers. So what we want to actually compute is not the determinant of this operator, but rather the determinant with the zero eigenvalue removed, because we already accounted for that. So this determinant should be basically the determinant we saw in QFT2, but we have to remove the zero eigenvalue. It's already accounted for here. Okay, and so in our approximation, this is the leading term, at least for the solutions we found so far. So these solutions all involve the particle going from minus A to A once. There's no reason that the particle couldn't make multiple trips back and forth between A and minus A. So this instanton solution basically corresponds to tunneling from minus A to A. We'd also expect there should be solutions where the particle tunnels from minus A to A, back to minus A, and back to A again. So we need to look for solutions like that. So this is one contribution to the amplitude we're trying to compute. This is the contribution from the one instanton solutions to the equation of motion. Yes?
But the way that we solved the equation, the classical equation, was to consider the real time problem with the reverted potential, right?
Yes.
And in that reverted potential, it doesn't make sense to go from minus A to A and then back to minus A, because if you reached A, you reached with like positive energy, right? With momentum going that direction, so you would fall, right? You would never come back.
Well, so in the inverted potential, our inverted potential looks like this, and at these maxima for the inverted potential, the potential energy is zero, and we're looking for zero energy solutions.
Oh, so we reach stationary.
So we reach the maximum with zero momentum. So we.
And how would we? But then, if we start at minus A, we would never move unless this is like one of those situations that the Notre Dame dome.
For finite t, you're correct. In the infinite t limit, basically, what can happen is that for finite t, we get exponentially close to A. So we saw last time that here it gets exponentially close and reaches A just at t goes to infinity. So in the at t tau goes to t over 2. So we reach the maximum of the inverted potential here. We're exponentially close here. But we're ultimately interested in the t goes to infinity limit. And so in the t goes to infinity limit, what solutions will look like is, so here's A, here's minus A. We need to start at minus A, and we can and have an instanton that goes to A, and it'll become exponentially close to A, and then it can come back to minus A, and so on. So we can do this multiple times. So this is an approximate solution in the finite t limit, because we're only exponentially close to A here. If we just superpose multiple instantons and anti-instantons. And you can show, actually, that the it becomes a solution to the equation of motion in the t goes to infinity limit. So the error in solving the equation of motion just by superposing these instanton and anti-instanton solutions goes to zero in that limit. So you have sufficiently, if these are sufficiently far apart, you can basically reach A. So this solution I've sketched here is known as a multi-instanton solution. And it's basically just stitching together instantons and anti-instantons and becomes an exact solution in the t goes to infinity limit. Provided the instantons and anti-instantons are sufficiently separated. Okay.
Can you explain the zero eigenvalue remark again?
Yes. So the idea is, so what we're trying to compute is this amplitude, which we can write as an integral from path integral with particular boundary conditions. And the approximation we're doing is we are approximating S near its saddle points. And so we're expanding S of x as being s of some saddle point configuration plus some fluctuations times s double prime times the fluctuations plus higher order terms. And so we know, based on the fact that the center, the location of the center of the instanton doesn't enter in this calculation at all. We've got a one-parameter family of solutions, which all have exactly the same action. So that there's some direction in the space of trajectories, which is flat, completely flat. So if we look to a perturbation of S in that direction, all of these higher order terms are zero, including the second derivative term. And so that tells us that there is a zero eigenvalue for S double prime, because all of the derivatives are zero in that particular direction in the space of trajectories.
That seems very much saying that S prime is zero. Like that argument in terms of, because the constancy of S guarantees that S prime equals zero, but why would S double prime equal to zero also? Because S prime equals zero alone?
Whole in that whole line. Mm-hmm. Whole line in configuration space. Okay.
Can you elaborate a bit on why this is a multi-instanton solution? So like, where is it? What do you mean by anti-instantons?
Multi-instantons. So this, if I just zoom in on this part of this multi-instanton solution, this part that I've drawn a box around is just an instanton solution with some particular center. And then to that instanton solution, I'm attaching a anti-instanton solution, which is just the time reverse of the instanton solution. Then another instanton, another anti-instanton, another instanton. So this solution is literally just pasting together the instanton and anti-instanton solutions.
For the same potential and like.
Yes, we're still considering the same potential. These multi-instanton solutions also solve the same equations of motion with the same boundary conditions. So they also contribute to this amplitude we're trying to compute. So these are This is one term in the approximation to this amplitude we're trying to compute, but there are additional terms that come from these multi-instanton solutions.
Well, what would the additional terms be looking like? Like you said that this is the kind of like the first order term, but
Yes, that's what I'm going to discuss next. So these multi-instanton solutions, in order to determine the next term here, we need to find the Euclidean action of these solutions. And the Euclidean action of these solutions, we can get just by noting that for these solutions, the particle is almost always near minus A when A, except for the small regions where it crosses over from minus A to A. And so when the particle is near minus A or plus A, its velocity is very small, as we can see from this graph. And it's also near the point on our potential where the potential energy is zero. So both terms in our Euclidean action are very small and basically zero. So essentially, all of the contribution to the Euclidean action comes from these regions where the particle is traversing from minus A to A or vice versa. And so if there are n instantons here, the Euclidean action here should just be n times the Euclidean action of the one instanton solution we found before. Because, well, if we do the integral over each of these regions, it's exactly the same integral as we did before. Okay. And so the only approximation we've made here is we've assumed that the centers of the instantons are well separated. So in other words, the density of the instantons are low. If they get too close together, well, then there could be some interactions. The particle won't have time to reach A and minus A, and it's not clear what we're doing. It doesn't have other corrections. But this approximation with the density is low is sometimes known as the dilute gas approximation. Okay. So we now have essentially what we need to compute the contributions of the other saddle points to the amplitude we're trying to compute. And so what we get is, well, there'll be some normalization like before. And we want to include all possible multi-instanton configurations. So we want to sum over the possible allowed multi-instanton solutions. But there's a restriction on the number of instantons we can have, our total number of instantons and anti-instantons, because of our boundary conditions. So we're starting from minus A and we're ending at A. And we have to alternate instantons and anti-instantons. So we have to have an odd number of instantons and anti-instantons. So if we're starting out at minus A, the only thing we can do first is have an instanton that takes us to A. The only thing we can do next is have a anti-instanton, which takes us back to minus A. And if we want to end up with at A, we also need to go back to A. So we could have one instanton or two instantons and an anti-instanton, et cetera.
The anti-incentons are getting negative action?
The anti-incentons have positive action. The anti-incentons is just the time reverse of this. But if we look at our equation up at the top of this board for the Euclidean action, so this involves the square of the velocity, which is always positive, and this term doesn't care about which way we're going. So the anti-instanton has exactly the same Euclidean action as the instanton.
But then shouldn't we sum separately over instantons or anti-instantons because given if I have a half n equals one, I could have obtained n equals one by doing three instantons and two anti-instantons?
So here n is referring to the total number of instantons plus anti-instantons. It's not the number of instantons, it's the total number. And that uniquely specifies the configuration. Okay, so we need to sum over the possible solutions to our equations of motion. And each term in the sum is basically going to look with small modifications like the term we found before. So we need to also first we have the exponential of minus n s naught over h bar. Euclidean action is just n times what we had before. We also need to integrate over the possible locations of the centers of the instantons. And if we don't want to overcount, the first instanton can be anywhere. But the second one should be, if we say the first one is the one at the latest time, the second one should be between minus t over 2 and tau 1. And the third one should be, et cetera. So the last one should be between minus t over 2 and tau n minus 1. And then finally, we should include the fluctuations around each instanton. Where this is just the determinant, like before, with the zero eigenvalues, which we've already accounted for or removed. I've done something not quite right and doesn't quite line up with what I just said a few minutes ago. Does anyone see a potential issue with this formula? Earlier, I said these multi-instanton solutions were solutions so long as the instantons were well separated, the density was low. Does that match what I did over here? So, if we look at this integral, we're integrating over all possible locations in the center, including the case where, say, all of them are at minus t over 2. That's, it could all be piled up on top of each other. That solution, well, that's not a solution to the Euclidean equations of motion. That's, we're doing something a little bit wrong here. But what we can show, I'll show in a few minutes that actually this overcounting the configurations that we're overcounting actually contribute negligibly to this term. So we've essentially finished computing our amplitude. You can do a little bit of work to simplify this expression. These integrals, you can show that they work out to be just t to the n over n factorial. And this sum can be done. It's just if there wasn't a restriction that n was odd, this is just the Taylor expansion of an exponential. So I'm just missing a few terms. And if you count for those missing terms, what we get is c over 2 e to the kt, and in the exponential, e to the minus s naught h bar, then minus e to the minus kt e to the minus s naught over h bar. Okay. We've computed this amplitude, and we found this result. What we are ultimately interested in computing is the energy splitting between the two lowest lying energy states. And A and minus A, as we can see from our result, are clearly not energy eigenstates. They mix under time evolution. So they can't be energy eigenstates. But the energy eigenstates will turn out to be linear combinations of A and minus A. And in order to extract the energy eigenvalues from this calculation, we also need to compute the amplitude for a particle to go from A to A and minus A to minus A. It's almost the same calculation. What will change is that instead of summing over n odd, we'll sum over n even. And the result of that will be this sign will flip. And so we now have all elements of the transition matrix from A or minus A to A or minus A. And we can then diagonalize that matrix to find the energy eigenvalues. I won't go through that algebra on the board, but what you will find is if you diagonalize then can show that the energy eigenstates are just 1 over root 2 A minus plus minus A, and the energy eigenvalues are half h bar omega plus or minus h bar k e to the minus s naught over h bar. So this term comes from our calculation. And that's because, well, essentially, so last time is that the exponent here tells us about the ground state energy. We need to take the limit. The ground state energy was the limit as t goes to infinity, the minus sign of minus 1 over t is the log of our amplitude. And probably missing an h bar. So the splitting comes from these instanton solutions we've computed, and the expected result for the unperturbed is just the familiar harmonic oscillator energy, and this comes from the normalization. So you can either just say we know that that's the answer we have to get because it's just the harmonic oscillator plus some corrections, or you can go through it more detail and actually compute this constant C. There's some references in the notes about how to do that, but I'm not going to discuss that further. Okay, so we recovered precisely the energy splitting we expected. It's just this exponential of minus the action, which was just the integral of root 2v, same result you'd get from doing the WKB approximation. And, well, one point left to check is what we made some approximation here by integrating over all possible locations of the centers. So just a few words about why that's okay, something okay to do. So we want to check whether or not our dilute gas approximation is good. And so which terms, to check that, we should check which terms in our sum provide the dominant contributions. So terms in our sum are like sum x to the n over n factorial. Essentially, if we look at this line, we've got an n factorial, and then everything else is just some quantity to the nth power. And the terms in a series like this grow until x is about n. And so the most important terms are the terms with x less than or equal to n. And so if we look at our sum here, the most important terms have kt e to the minus s naught over h bar less than or n, less than or equal to n. Sorry, greater than or equal to n? Yes. So these are the important terms. And if we just rearrange this equation, we can write this as k e to the minus s naught over h bar is greater than or equal to n over t. And this is the density. And so we see that the density is small as long as S naught over H bar is big. And that's exactly when we expect the semi-classical approximation to be good. And that's essentially what we've been doing. So if the semi-classical approximation is good, we're allowed to expand the action and just keep a small number of terms, then the density is low and we're okay to sum over all configurations. Any further questions on this first example?
Can you go over this part again, when the semi-classical expansion is true?
Are you okay with up where this equation comes from, or? Okay, so
it's coming from the assumption that we made about that.
Okay, are you okay with the first line? Okay, so the second line just says if we look at this line is a sum like x to the n over n factorial, where x is k t e to the minus s naught over h bar. So the terms in this sum that are most important are the ones where this x, this kt e to the minus s naught, is bigger than n. Once n becomes too big, then the n factorial wins and the terms contribute negligibly. So these are the most important terms. I can just divide this by t to put the density on the right-hand side of the equation. And then if the density is small, then our approximations are good. If the dominant contributions come from regions where the density is small, then approximations are good. The density is guaranteed to be small if we were allowed to expand the action in the way we did at the very start of our calculation. That's guaranteed. Okay, so that's our first calculation using instantons. And basically, all the rest of the calculations we're going to do will build off this. So first, I want to briefly comment on two other cases in quantum mechanics and just comment on a few of the differences. We'll look at these in a little bit more detail in a tutorial next week. And these two examples I'm going to choose are chosen because they have direct applications to quantum field theory. So they're slightly more involved, although I'm only going to point out the differences there than this example we looked at, but they're also more directly applicable to quantum field theory. And the first example is the periodic potential, where potential looks something like this. V of x, which x. Again, we'll choose our minima to be at zero potential. And we'll assume our potential looks something like this, where in some units, say the distance between these is one. And again, we'll assume it looks locally like a harmonic oscillator at each of the minima. And that's basically all we'll need. The reason this potential is interesting is it will have some relevance to gauge theory. So next week, we're going to study the vacuum structure of non-abelian gauge theory. And there are some very close analogies between what happens in non-abelian gauge theory and this potential. And the main difference between what we already did and this potential is that in a periodic potential, particle can tunnel from any minimum to any other minimum. And we can have So we could ask, what's the amplitude to go from, say, minus 2 to... say 5. That this amplitude will be non-zero, and there will be finite action solutions to the equations of motion with these boundary conditions. So there are more choices of boundary conditions that will give us finite action solutions. And so what we can consider, so what we would want to compute would be the amplitude to go from, say, x equals k to x equals l. And that amplitude is going to be almost the same as what we saw before, except that one difference is we can stitch together our instantons and anti-instantons in any order we like. So before, in the double well potential, once we tunneled from minus A to A, we had to go back. There's nowhere else to tunnel to. Here, we can continue in one direction as far as we like, and then go back and do that in any order. So we can sum over. So our sum should involve a double sum over counting the instantons and anti-instantons separately. So here, unlike before, n is the number of instantons, and n bar is the number of anti-instantons. And we can have any number of each, subject to the constraint that we need to go a total distance of l minus k. So n minus n bar should be equal to l minus k. And otherwise, everything is the same. So we still will get a 1 over n factorial, 1 over n bar factorial, and the kt e to the minus s naught over h bar to the n plus n bar. And as we'll see in tutorial next week, this difference leads to a continuum of low energy, low-lying energy eigenstates. Are there any questions on what changes in the periodic case?
I'm just wondering where the continuum comes from, because we still have like a discrete.
Yes, we'll discuss that more in tutorial next week. But basically, so what we want to do is, again, take the define the energy eigenstates. We need to take the log and the limit of this divided by t. And well, we've got this delta here. And so that we can re-express this delta in terms of a Fourier integral that will involve a continuous parameter beta. And that's essentially where it's going to come from. But we'll see that in more detail next week. Another reason you might expect that there is a continuum is because we have an infinite set of degenerate minima, and so it could be possible that there was a gap, but in general you might not expect that because of the infinite degeneracy. So
is the theory theory, it's sensible to imagine halfway up on your potential, there is a small well where you could be, and then you will all break down to more instantons that just go from half the way, makes sense. Instead of having
a yes.
wave, having a, another well in the middle of the...
So you're imagining a potential that looks something like this?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, there could be there could be the instanton method still be relevant for studying this potential, and this is related actually to what I'm gonna say next about the decay of metastable states. So this would be a slightly more complicated potential to look at than one I'm about to discuss, but yes, the potentials I'm choosing are just the simplest ones where we can use this method, but there are other potentials, not this one, where we could have could use instantons. Okay, so the final quantum mechanical example I want to briefly say something about is a metastable state. So I'm imagining here that the potential looks something like this, with again a minimum at zero. We're always choosing that just for convenience, so that our trivial solution has zero action. So this potential is unbounded from below, and as I mentioned last time, doesn't really have a ground state, but we can still sort of talk about a ground state. What we're really discussing are the resonant states of what the state, the states that are localized near this metastable minimum, what are those? What are their energies? Our resonant energies. And so if we wanted to apply the instanton method to study this potential, what we need to study, find our finite action solutions of a particle moving in the inverted potential. The inverted potential looks something like this. And in this case, there's only one possible choice of our initial and final position that's going to give us a finite action solution to the equations of motion. And that is when the particle starts and ends at this point I'm calling xi. So we want to find our solutions, unlike before, that start our basic solution is going to start and end at the same point. So we want a solution that starts at xi and at minus t over 2, ends at xi at plus t over 2. And in between, it should, well, the non-trivial solution will go over to x star, the other point where the potential is 0, and then bounce back. So we want to sketch the solution. So when it's near, so it should be a zero energy solution again for to have finite action. And so the zero energy solution with these boundary conditions should start moving very slowly when it's near xi, go fast when it's over in this region, and go slowly again near x star. So it should look something like this. And this solution is known as a bounce, as it goes to x star and bounces back. And So in most of the other respects, the calculation carries over with no changes. The difference is, there's two differences. One is that the sort of building block solution is no longer an instanton. It's a bounce solution, which has somewhat different boundary conditions. And that has one important effect, because as we saw, as I mentioned before, the decay rate, which is what we might be interested in calculating for an unstable potential, is related to the imaginary part of the ground state energy. So we want, if we're calculating the decay rate, we want our energy to be imaginary. And well, we look at our calculation from before. Let's say this one. So there's still going to be a real, the solution is still going to have a real Euclidean action. So one place where our answer could become imaginary is due to this factor k, essentially the determinant of S double prime. And it turns out that S double prime will have one imaginary eigenvalue. So that E naught will be imaginary. Sorry, one negative eigenvalue. And to see that, it's a short calculation that we'll do in a tutorial, but the basic idea is that, so we're looking for solutions to the equation x, s double prime, x, lambda n, xn. And what we'll show is that there's a solution, which I'll call x1, which is proportional to the x bar e tau, that has lambda 1 equals 0. And it's a solution to this equation with, and it has one node. You can, just from the sketch, you can see that x dx bar d tau is 0 exactly once. And so just like in quantum mechanics, the wave functions with the ground state wave function has 0 nodes. The first excited state has 1 node. So that tells us that if this, as I claimed, and you'll show next week, that this eigenfunction has 0 eigenvalue in 1 node, there has to be another eigenfunction with a negative eigenvalue. So that makes the energy imaginary, which is precisely what we want for computing a k rate. Are there any questions on the metastable state? We didn't quite make it to quantum field theory applications, but we'll get there next week. And we'll start with the quantum mechanical version of this problem. And we'll see that we've done most of the work in computing the decay rate of an metastable field configuration in quantum field theory. So what we'll be looking at is scalar field theories where the potential looks something like this. So we can start off with a field configuration where the field is in a homogeneous state localized near some metastable vacuum, and well, you might expect that tunneling can occur in quantum field theory as well, and that we'll see how that happens. So what will happen is a bubble will nucleate where the field is mostly near the true vacuum. And so that we'll compute the rate at which that happens. That's what we'll look at next time. Are there any further questions? All right, I'll see you next week.